Okay. We now have the first question from the back of the room. Rod.
Thanks, Bo. My question is in relation to hospital funding to Tony. So it's really about, I mean, one of the big problems coming from the primary health sector is that health networks tend to swallow up what seems, when you're sitting in the primary healthcare sector, as a hell of a lot of primary healthcare funding, which in turn stops the primary healthcare sector building its capacity outside of the hospital because a lot of resources are swallowed up within a health network. And I would argue that actually that's one of the things that stops us building a very strong primary healthcare sector. But I think up to 40%, 30 or 40% of hospital budgets are actually for what I would think are probably non-hospital activities. Now, that in itself is not, I don't think, very good, but the added problem is it actually stops primary healthcare services actually getting stronger. So is that an issue of, A, do you agree with that, and B, is that an issue that is likely to be addressed? I suppose shorthand for that is, where does the job of a hospital start and end?
It's a good question. And the National Health Reform Agreement could be criticised for focusing too much on hospitals and not enough on the articulation between primary, community care and hospitals. I think that's a fair criticism. So if I'm asked, which I'm not sure if I will be, but if I'm asked, I'll certainly advise any government that it would be a good idea next health reform agreement to make sure it's all embracing or at least all acknowledging and rather than focused on hospitals. And the funding system needs to support that immigration process. I think ABF does help in a way, though, with your issue, and that at least it brings transparency to what the hospital is producing so that you can make you and communities, local hospital network boards, PHN governing bodies, whatever they'll be, can make a decision about whether, or at least an evaluation about whether their community is getting what they want out of a hospital, and whether they're getting good value for that service. And apropos of your point about inappropriate hospital care or misallocated hospital care, if you like, I don't know if I'd agree with 30%. Hospitals are incredibly, I mean, John Dwyer and others who work in the coalface will tell you just how intense hospital care is these days. People like me have been out of it for a while, just don't realise how much it's changed. But nevertheless, your basic point's still valid, that there is an element of hospital care that could well be managed in the community. And New Zealand shows us that, and the UK as well. Mind you, we're not as bad as we think. But on the other hand, at least ABF will give you an idea. You can see what the hospital's doing, and those issues of appropriateness can be debated. One of the things that John Horvath was trying to get at a little bit in his report, at least he was in discussions beforehand, is that PHNs, when they're created, whatever they're finally called, and LHNs, local hospital networks, need to work together. And there was some stream of advice at one point that there should be an overlap in governance, at least in personnel, if not responsibilities, to drive the two together. And at one stage, we were going to try and use the much-derided lead clinicians groups. We were going to try and enforce is the wrong term, but incentivize an integration of primary care and secondary and tertiary care clinicians together in some sort of organised process. So anyway, so hopefully that process that you're involved in with the PHN developments will recognise the importance of articulating with hospitals, and at the same time, governments, when they come to organise the next health reform agreement, will recognise the importance of making sure hospitals interface with PHNs and other primary care providers. So, yeah, I think your point's valid, but ABF helps measure what you're concerned about and debate what you're concerned about.
Thanks, Rod. Russell?
My question follows on a bit from that, and it's about how we integrate primary health care through sub-acute care to acute care hospital services, and then what implications that might have for what can be done in primary health care and preventative health and sub-acute. And this is particularly relevant to John, who's raised this this need for health channels, which I think are exemplified in some ways by the renal services that are cross-border and really look at integration upwards, vertically, if you like, as well as providing more integrated services more generally. So I just wondered, starting with John, if he could talk a bit about how that renal management occurs in the cross-border setting here in the ACT, and then what implications that has for sub-acute type services such as dialysis in the satellite clinics and home dialysis, and then how that Heather might be able to comment on how preventative health and generally maintenance of health might be achieved through those mechanisms. Particularly in Tony's case, the fact that you are activity-based funding sub-acute services when they seem to fit more naturally with primary health care and community health.
Okay. The Renal Services Network is cross-border as of earlier this year. In some respects, it's actually a lot easier than other kinds of integration. First of all, we already capture New South Wales patients because Canberra Hospital is where the renal specialists are primarily located, etc. That's not to say that there weren't some mountains to climb to get there. The reality is that Southern Local Health District and the ACT in the renal services context actually identified a very strong mutual interest in working together. So in terms of administrative elements, we're trying to get a governance over the network. We're trying to align the money with the enterprise. We're running into all sorts of wonderful cross-border issues, particularly around data storage and the way New South Wales Health operates its IT and where patient data is stored and all the rest of that sort of stuff. Those are management issues, and they'll be dealt with, however clumsily to start with, but that's what's happening. I think there's a couple of really more important points that are in this. The first is that the theme is to take specialty practice to the community for the community, and to have a patient-centered, I'd say citizen-centered is a much better word for it, service. That has meant that our clinicians are now going out to New South Wales rather than the established renal patients coming to the ACT. We're now integrating all of nursing practice across all of the sites. We're moving toward a complete electronic network, and that's up and running for the most part. It's not across the border, but you know we're moving on that. The interesting thing about the IT there is it's the first time I've ever seen an IT system that's starting to look like an IT system we might want, e.g. the clinicians are actually having control over how the darn thing is designed and operate. And that's brought forward a bunch of issues about quality and about choreography and what you can expect from each other. And it's rapidly becoming this way or the highway. Because part of the issue here is that we're actually mandating that people fill in things to know so that we can do the quality assurance later. It's also forcing clinicians to go and look at the evidence base and to coordinate between nursing and clinical, or sorry, doctors, etc. And so that's all going ahead. Patients like myself are becoming very active in these discussions at the quality and governance level, which is a real tip of the hat to the doctors because they've allowed us to come in and take a lead sometimes. The much more challenging question is that the IT systems are designed for renal because that's their worldview. And IT does an information model that suits a worldview. We can do scale. We just can't do scope, and we can't do reach. So for us to talk to diabetes,
is a heck of a challenge. Cardiology, you name it, those are where the clinical integration is going to be the most apparent, and that's part of the reason that the focus on the asthma one is so critical, because the asthma example takes you right up to a patient outcome that we're all trying to get, talked about having to work through what integration means, what we can expect from each other, the data issues in order to get quality data that each clinician could trust and act on, particularly emergency department, was paramount, and we spent months getting that sorted. And then you run up against a model of care which cuts across every funding model we've got, and it makes it a nightmare to try and figure out how you support that stuff on an ongoing basis. So I would love to see us be able to, in terms of integration and the like, to have a separate stream that talks about, you know, what we're trying to achieve and how, what that's predicated on, and then work it down to human relations, behavior, communication flows before we get anywhere near the IT. Because the IT people, they're like kids with toys. You know, they know their toys, and their toy must work for you. And they're not trying to be unhelpful. It's just they're trying to be helpful through their eyes. And we need to separate that, but bring them in where they have value to add.
Heather, do you want to?
Well, it's certainly a tricky one, but one that, you know, we're intelligent people. We should be able to put something out in that sense. We haven't necessarily tackled it in the right way. And the primary healthcare networks, as they will be or were Medicare locals, were starting to really pull together the local intelligence around the health status and the health, local health indices. And I know our group was really looking at some of the social factors there and doing some really nice qualitative research to match up with quantitative and so on. And local councils have got some good mapping to try and get that overlay of where the pockets are and link that with CIFA indexes and so on. But then there's the communication with, well, where are the services and the primary healthcare services, English language services, multicultural services and so on, how do they link in? And then you've got the treatment services, the healthcare services, and it's a little bit like what Pradesh was saying about it's a really complex network, but then you've got these little smaller networks which are complex as well, and you then have to try and, well, if you ping this bit here, what's the ramification across the system? But one of the first things is really to acknowledge that there are these networks and of information and really building up those networks and then trying to work out how you get those networks to talk to each other. Then you can start the modelling, and certainly Sharon Friel yesterday was talking about that in relation to social determinants, that you need to have that integrated model there to understand all of the components of the system at some level. And then you can start looking at the tipping points, whether it's a funding-related issue, whether it's a policy-related issue, whether it's a locational issue in terms of where you put the housing commission locations, or a school issue, or whatever it might be. So there's systems within systems, and I don't think we've really tackled that in any systematic way. We've tended to be linear rather than complex at this point.
Any part of this overlay in ABF framework or does it?
Russ's comment to that, sub-acute care, we already include that in our pricing regime. Mm-hmm. And the same points, I think, that we mentioned earlier about integration still apply. Yeah.
John.
Thank you. I'd like to make a comment and ask John a question. The comment is that, as I understand it, the government is talking about perhaps having 21 primary health networks down from 60. For a country this size, we none of us could believe the stupidity of setting up the Medicare locals that were not geographically co-located and in a structural sense fused with the local health networks. That was an unbelievable stupid thing government did. I don't know how 21 networks would work. If you look at the New Zealand model, they have some large networks, but they've got hub and spoke models where there's a much more intimate relationship between the Medicare Local, which is actually a primary healthcare organisation, and satellite practices. And that central hub does purchasing, continuing education, data gathering, and they run 23-hour wards. And if you're a Pegasus, if you're a patient enrolled in Pegasus in Christchurch and you're going to Takabasi, you don't go to the hospital, you go to your to Pegasus, and 80% of those patients go straight home from there. So I think that there's so much we can learn from other systems, and we need to make a far more intimate relationship between these umbrella groups and satellite practices. That's the comment. The question, John, is that in the last 6 months I've had the opportunity of visiting a number of countries that were celebrating 10 years or more of an effective electronic health record. Mm-hmm. When I went to Casa Permanente in California, they gave me a present. It was a book on their first 10 years of experience with the electronic health record, detailing voluminous papers they'd published on how quality, safety, etc., improved. I understand the people in Holland just bought one straight from IBM, and then the IBM people spent a couple of years refining it. Why on earth are we taking so long? We seem to be trying to reinvent an Australian electronic health record. Why aren't we using these Germany and Italy and others have got such good data, and building on that framework of experience, something that may have to have some unique Australian characteristics.
Thank you, John. Just before John has the opportunity to answer it, Tony just informed me that he has to leave at 4:30. So I just want to thank Tony for your presentation and appear on the panel first. Now over to you, John.
I want to come at it from two perspectives. One is that I think we need, at the core, a shared view of the patient, the health, the person, with a patient dimension to it. And that has different levels of detail because its purpose is different for each one of them. The second thing is that I think we have to acknowledge that in every domain, science and technological innovation and development are driving change in the way we understand people and the data that we collect about them. And so we have a very complex juggling act going on here where at one level, to make it work effectively, efficiently, safely for the various clinicians, it needs to be focused on them being highly productive. And that means when you talk to real specialists, that's very little data once they know who's who out there, and they can go like that. When you get people that don't know as much, the amount of information you have to provide for them starts to go up. Junior docs are a good example of that. That's one aspect of the electronic health record. The second aspect is the one that really drives me up the wall, is that healthcare, what I call, speaks medical. I don't understand most of what is going on in the language you use, and so we have now started talking about translating things like path result reports into action that I and my fellow patients and their carers can convert into, well, the clinician might ask you to do something about these choices, and then you can do these things yourself. Now, that's a medical or health record, and I carry one with me all the time because it's the only way I can keep all my clinicians on board and on the same page. That's a different thing. It's a thing that's about me and my contribution and me being able to interact with the system. Then, when you start looking at all of the interested parties that float around healthcare and health, you have a whole variety of agendas. And I think it's why we come back to having some kind of coherent, agreed understanding of how we're going to deal with atomic elements and then how we're going to network information flows around that. My personal view, PCHR is dead in the water, and we'd be best getting rid of it with one caveat, that we must save those parts which help us to build a future system where the record is actually a repository of my information to start with, but it is clinically relevant and clinically trusted. But it is the base upon which all this mobile health and all the rest of this stuff plugs in and helps me make my part. If we have networks of clinical provision in provider land, et cetera, and mine, then we can start asking intelligent questions. And I was talking to one of the participants here about what New Zealand did back in the late 80s. They actually set up a network for parliamentarians and government more broadly to ask questions of general practice about things like, well, what's the effect on healthcare of unemployment? And so they set up an ability to ask questions. And then those questions went through ethics and privacy, all that kind of mechanism. And then they were translated into requests of the various software systems. They then went out, reported on, went back, small cell issues were dealt with, and then they had results they could depend on when they made policy. Now, I think we can think about that in a whole variety of contexts, but I come back to the basic issue here. There are some strategic building blocks we have to architecturally get correct. Institutionally, we have to understand how these pieces fit together so that I can make my contribution as a citizen of this country. And that is something that's a tool that's tailored for me and helps me report my progress, but it equally allows me to have an effective conversation with clinicians where I don't understand half of the damn language you use, and made worse by bloody pharmaceutical companies that keep changing the names of their products. So I think there's been a lot of good work that's been done. I just think it's missed the human dimension and hasn't really got to how the heck do we actually get an integrated view where all the parties can now start seeing where their contribution comes. I think in Australia we have, with a community rating-based system, far better chance of making something work where we can have public and private investment and the rest of it come in. I think if we could get more coherent, I think we could drag in a pile of investment from elsewhere because nobody's got an integrated system that provides any investment surety. So I'll stop there. I hope that's helped answer your question.
Okay, another one in the back.
Would be that we've got the social determinants kind of approach, which I'm totally supportive of, and then we have sort of a health reform agenda, and in a sense they're sort of slightly disconnected. It's very hard for clinicians and people who are in healthcare service delivery to adequately explain the connections to the social determinants, and it seems regrettably that the people who are working more strongly on the social determinants side of the ledger having difficulty saying how a reformed healthcare system could actually help address social determinants. Are we getting into a sort of siloed discussion about, you know, social determinants versus health reform when, in my view, they should be entirely the same thing and entirely? It's very hard to find people who talk across that continuum and are able to join the dots either from the health practitioner point of view or from the social determinants point of view.
Certainly I can only agree with you on that, and then you add another dimension such as the importance of environment and climate change on health. So social determinants is really around the societal structures, and then you've got the environment structures which are more related to nature and climate, and then you've got, well, where do the practitioners fit within all that? And I think one of the issues that we haven't been particularly good at is during education and training to really have these sorts of discussions with the students as they go through so that they can start to form frameworks to engage in those that type of public discussion about healthcare, healthcare services, social determinants, environmental health, how do they all connect? They don't necessarily have a good framework to engage in the discussion. So that would be one area. Another area, unfortunately, and I was talking about this over the break time, one of the examples that I forgot to mention about a possible role of, or the role model of a healthcare practitioner engaging in some wider discussion. And I was going to use the example of A&E specialists engaging in debates around alcohol policy. And then I heard that in some states that discussion was actually closed down by the health department as not a fit role for those health specialists to engage in a policy debate, because they would be then seen to be criticising government policy, and that wasn't what they were employed to be doing. So there are some structural constraints of particularly individual health practitioners being involved. But that's where alliances and professional associations become critically important, where they can do that connecting of the dots so it doesn't come back to individuals, but that health message about, well, the health system is critically important to social determinants in a whole heap of different ways, you know, access, availability, cost, vulnerable communities, where the focus is in terms of primary health care versus tertiary and getting the balance right and so on. So that is obviously critical to underpin people's day-to-day lives in conjunction with the education system and maybe the, you know, dialogue between health practitioners with the education department about national curriculum. And where is health literacy within the national curriculum? You know, hands up in the room, how many people have actually contributed to the submission process for the national curriculum discussion? Critically important, because if our health voice isn't there, it's not going to be part of the rollout of the national curriculum, and so health literacy isn't going to be taught to our students and our children, and we're perpetuating the issue. So I think there is certainly a role where I think we can could do better on our own report cards there. And part of that is education, but I think there's a very active role for the professional associations to promote that as well. Thank you for the question.
We're rapidly running out of time, so are there any burning last-minute questions? No? Okay. Just want to thank our remaining panellists, Heather and John.
Last people standing
or sitting, as it were. Thank you very much. And I now ask Tony to make some closing remarks.